The older one, the one with the knife gesturing at me. Skinny bird, what's she gonna do? Breathe, Emma. Breathe, Carol instructs, touching his knife against the base of my throat. Because if she does try something, we'll cut her, right? No, I say sharply, panicked. I can't do this, I'm sorry. Carol sits back. You've done very well, Emma. Well done. I breathe some more, getting back my composure. I know from previous sessions it'll be up to me to break the silence now. But I don't want to talk about the burglary anymore. We may have found somewhere else to live, I say. Oh, yes. Carol's voice is as neutral as ever. Simon's flat's in a really horrible area, even before I made the crime figures worse. I bet the neighbors hate me. I've probably knocked 5% off the value of their homes. I'm sure they don't hate you, Emma, she says. I put the sleeve of my sweater into my mouth and suck at it. An old habit I seem to have started again. I say, I know moving's giving in, but I can't stay there. The police say with this sort of attacker, there's a chance they'll come back. They get a sense of ownership, apparently. Like you're somehow theirs now. Which you're not, of course, Carol says quietly. You are your own person, Emma, and I don't think moving on is giving in. Quite the opposite. It's a sign you're making decisions again, regaining control. I know it's hard at the moment, but people do come through this kind of trauma. You just have to accept that it takes time. She glances at the clock. Excellent work, Emma. You've made real progress today. I'll see you next week at the same time, shall I?
Now, Jane. 30. Which statement best describes your most recent personal relationship? More like friends than lovers? Easy and comfortable? Soulful and intense? Tempestuous and explosive? Perfect but short-lived? The questions on the application form seem to get odder and odder. To begin with, I try to give each one careful consideration, but there are so many that by the end I'm hardly even thinking about my answers. I'm just dashing them off on instinct. They want 3 recent photographs. I choose one taken at a friend's wedding, a selfie of me and Mia climbing Snowdon a couple of years back, and a formal portrait I had done for work. And then it's done. I write a covering letter, nothing over the top, just a polite note emphasizing how much I like 1 Folgate Street and how I will strive to live there with the integrity it deserves. Even though it's just a few lines, I redraft it 6 times before I'm happy with it. The agent said not to get my hopes up, that most applicants never get past this stage, but I go to bed really hoping I will. A new beginning, a fresh start. And as I drift off to sleep, another word floats into my brain as well. A rebirth.
2. When I'm working on something, I can't relax until it's perfect. Agree or disagree?
Then, Emma. A week goes by with no response to our application. Then another. I send an email checking they've received it. There's no reply. I'm starting to get pissed off. They made us answer all those stupid questions, choose the photographs, write a letter. The least they could do is write back saying we haven't made it to the next stage. When finally, an email arrives from admin@themonkfordpartnership.com. Subject: 1 Folgate Street. I don't give myself time to get nervous. I open it immediately. Please come for an interview 5 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, March 16th, at the Monkford Partnership. Nothing else. No address, no details, no indication if we're meeting Edward Monkford himself or some underling. But of course the address is easily found online and it doesn't really matter who we're meeting. This is it. We've cleared every hurdle but the last one. The Monkford Partnership occupies the top floor of a well-known modern building in the city. It has an address, but most people just call it the Hive, because that's what it looks like, a giant stone beehive. Among all the boxy glass and steel skyscrapers in the square mile, it sits on the approach to St. Paul's like some weird, pale chrysalis laid by an alien. And from street level, it's even stranger. There's no reception desk, just a long wall of pale stone with two slits that must lead to the lifts, because there's a steady stream of people coming in and out. All of them, both men and women, seem to be wearing expensive black suits and open-necked shirts. I feel my phone buzz. Something's flashed onto the screen. The Monkford building. Check in now. I touch accept. Welcome, Emma and Simon. Please take lift 3 and get out at floor 14. I've no idea how the building has identified us. Perhaps there was a cookie embedded in the email. Simon knows about that kind of techie stuff. I show him, hoping it'll excite him, but he just shrugs dismissively. Places like this, rich, moneyed, self-confident, aren't his cup of tea. There's no one else waiting for our lift, apart from a man who looks even more out of place here than us. His hair is long and grey, unkempt even though it's tied back in a ponytail. He has a 2-day growth of stubble, and he's wearing a moth-eaten cardigan and shabby linen trousers. I glance at his feet and see he isn't even wearing shoes, just socks. He's eating some chocolate, a crunchy bar, very noisily. As the lift doors open, he shuffles inside and takes up a position at the back. I look around for buttons, but there aren't any. I guess it only goes to the floors it's programmed to. As we go up, so smoothly there's no sense of movement, I feel the man's eyes travelling over me. They come to rest on my midriff, and there they stay as he licks chocolate crumbs off his fingers. Awkwardly, I put my hand where he's looking and find my shirt has ridden up. A small patch of bare stomach is showing just above my trousers. "What's up, Em?" Simon says, noticing my discomfort. "Nothing," I say, turning to face him, away from the strange man, surreptitiously tucking my shirt in as I do so. "Changed your mind yet?" Simon says quietly. "I don't know," I say. In fact, I haven't. But I don't want Si to think I'm not open to a discussion about this. The lift doors open and the man shuffles off, still eating his crunchy. "Showtime," Simon says, looking around. It's another big, sleek space, an open, light-filled area running the length of the building. At one end, a wall of curved glass overlooks the city. You can see the Dome of St. Paul's, Lloyd's of London, all those other landmark buildings. Then Canary Wharf in the distance, the Thames snaking around the Isle of Dogs and off through the endless flat plains to the east. A blonde in a tailored black suit unfolds herself from a leather chair where she's tapping on an iPad. "Welcome, Emma and Simon," she goes. "Please take a seat. Edward will see you shortly." The iPad must be where all her emails are, because after 10 minutes of silence, she says, "Please follow me." She pushes open a door. Just from the way it moves, I can tell how heavy it is, how balanced. Inside, a man is standing at a long table, resting on his bald fists, studying some plans. The sheets are so big they only just fit on the table. Glancing at them, I see they aren't printouts, but actual drawings. 2 or 3 pencils and an eraser are grouped in one corner, neatly arranged in order of size. "Emma. Simon," the man says, looking up. "Would you like some coffee?" "Okay." So he's attractive. That's the first thing I notice about him. And the second. And the third. His hair is an indeterminate blonde, the short fair curls cropped close to his head. He's wearing a black pullover and an open-necked shirt. Nothing fancy. But the wool hangs nicely from his wide, lean shoulders. And he has a warm, slightly self-deprecating smile. He looks like a sexy, relaxed schoolteacher, not the strange obsessive I've been picturing. And Simon clearly clocks all this too, or sees me notice it, because he suddenly strides forward and grasps Edward Monkford's shoulder. "Edward, is it?" he goes. "Or Eddie? Ed? I'm Simon. Nice to meet you, mate. Swanky place you've got here. This is my girlfriend, Emma." And I cringe, because this mock Cockney thing is something Simon only ever does with people he feels threatened by. Quickly, I say, "Coffee would be great." "Two coffees, please, Alicia," Edward Monkford says to his assistant, very politely. He gestures me and Simon toward the other side of the table. "So tell me," he says when we're all seated, looking straight at me and ignoring Simon, "why you want to live at 1 Folgate Street?" "No, not a schoolteacher. A headmaster, or the chairman of the Board of Governors." His stare is still friendly, but a little bit fierce, too, which of course only makes him more attractive. We've anticipated this question, or something like it, and I managed to get out the answer we've prepared, something about how much we'll appreciate the opportunity and how we'll try to do the house justice. Next to me, Simon glowers silently. When I've finished, Monkford nods politely. He looks a bit bored. "And I think it will change us," I hear myself say. For the first time, he looks interested. "Change you? How?" "We were burgled," I say slowly. "Two men, well, kids really, teenagers. I can't actually remember what happened, not the details. I'm suffering from some kind of post-traumatic shock." He nods thoughtfully. Encouraged, I go on. "I don't want to be the person who just stood there and let them get away with it. I want to be someone who makes decisions, who fights back. And I think the house will help. I mean, we're not the sort of people who would normally live that way. All those rules. But we'd like to give it a go." Again, the silence stretches on. Mentally, I'm kicking myself. How can what happened to me possibly be relevant? How can the house make me a different person? The ice-cool blonde brings the coffees. I jump up to take one, and in my haste and nervousness, I somehow manage to spill the cup, the whole cup, over the drawings. "Jesus, Emma," Simon hisses, jumping up too. "Look what you're doing." "I'm so sorry," I say miserably, as the brown river slowly engulfs the designs. "God, I'm so sorry." The assistant rushes out to get cloths. I can see this opportunity slipping away. That dramatic blank list of possessions, all those hopeful lies I put in the questionnaire, they'll all count for nothing now. The last thing this man wants is a clumsy, coffee-spilling oaf messing up his beautiful house. To my surprise, Monkford only laughs. "They were terrible drawings," he says. "I should have ditched them weeks ago. You've saved me the bother." The assistant returns with paper towels and rushes around, dabbing and wiping. "Alicia, you're making it worse," Monkford says sharply. "Let me." He bundles up the drawings so the coffee's contained on the inside, like a giant diaper. "Dispose of that," he says, handing it to her. "Mate, I'm so sorry," Simon goes. For the first time, Monkford looks directly at him. "Never apologize for someone you love," he says quietly. "Makes you look like a prick." Simon's so stunned, he says nothing. I can only gape, astonished. Nothing in Edward Monkford's manner so far has suggested he would say anything so personal. And Simon has punched people for less, far less. But Monkford only turns back to me and says easily, "Well, I'll let you know. Thank you for coming, Emma." There's a brief pause before he adds, "And you, Simon."
Now, Jane. I wait in a reception area on the 14th floor of the Hive, watching two men argue in a glass-walled meeting room. One, I'm pretty sure, is Edward Monkford. He's wearing the same clothes as in a photo I found on the internet. Black cashmere pullover and white open-necked shirt, his fairish curls framing a lean, ascetic face. He's handsome. Not eye-catchingly so, but he has an air of confidence and charm, with a nice lopsided smile. The other man is shouting at him, although the glass is so thick I can't make out the words. It's as quiet as a laboratory up here. The man gesticulates furiously, thrusting both hands under Monkford's chin. Something about the gesture and the man's swarthiness makes me think he could be Russian. The woman standing to one side, occasionally adding an interjection of her own, could definitely be an oligarch's wife. Much younger than her husband, dressed in gaudy Versace prints, her sleek hair dyed an expensive shade of blonde. Her husband ignores her, but Monkford occasionally turns politely in her direction. When the man finally stops shouting, Monkford calmly says a few words and shakes his head. The man explodes again, even more angrily. The immaculate brunette who checked me in comes over. "I'm afraid Edward's still in a meeting. Can I get you anything? Some water?" "I'm fine, thank you." I nod at the tableau in front of me. "That meeting, I take it?" She follows my gaze. "They're wasting their time. He won't change it." "What are they arguing about?" "The client commissioned a house when he was in a previous marriage. Now his new wife wants an aga to make it more cozy," she says. "And the Monkford partnership doesn't do cozy." "That's not the point. If it wasn't agreed as part of the original commission, Edward won't make alterations, not unless it's something he's unhappy with. He once spent 3 months rebuilding the roof of a summer house to make it 4 feet lower." "What's it like, working for a perfectionist?" I say. But I've clearly crossed a line, because she just gives me a cool smile and moves away. I continue to watch the argument, or rather the rant, because Edward Monkford takes almost no part in it. He allows the other man's anger to wash over him like waves over a rock, his expression one of polite interest, no more. Eventually, the door is thrown open and the client storms out, still muttering, his wife teetering after him on her high heels. Monkford strolls out last. I smooth down my dress and stand up. After much consideration, I've gone for Prada. Navy blue, pleated, hemline just below the knee. Nothing too showy. "Jane Cavendish," the receptionist reminds him. He turns to look at me. Just for a moment, he seems surprised, startled even, as if I'm not quite what he'd expected. Then the moment passes, and he extends his hand. "Jane, of course, we'll go in here." I would sleep with this man. I've barely said more than hello to him, but I have nevertheless registered that something, some part of me quite beyond my conscious control, has made a judgment. He holds the meeting room door open for me, and somehow even this simple, everyday courtesy seems charged with significance. We sit opposite each other, across a long glass table dominated by an architectural model of a small town. I feel his gaze travelling across my face. When I'd decided he wasn't much more than reasonably good-looking, that was before I'd seen him up close. His eyes, in particular, are a striking pale blue. Although I know he's only in his 30s, their corners are etched with lines. Laughter lines, my grandmother used to call them. But on Edward Monkford, they give his face a fierce, hawk-like intensity. "Did you win?" I ask when he doesn't say anything. He seems to shake himself.
"Win what?"
"The argument."
"Oh, that."
He shrugs and smiles, and his face instantly softens.
"My buildings make demands of people, Jane. I believe they're not intolerable, and in any case, the rewards are far greater than the demands. In one sense, I suppose that's why you're here.
It is?
He nods. David, my technology partner, talks about something called UX. That's tech speak for user experience. As you'll be aware, having seen the terms and conditions of the lease, we gather information from One Folgate Street and use it to refine the user experience for our other clients. I'd actually skimmed most of the conditions document, which ran to about 20 pages of tiny print. What kind of information? He shrugs again. His shoulders under the sweater are broad but lean. Metadata, mostly. Which rooms you use most, that kind of thing. And from time to time, we'll ask you to redo the questionnaire to see how your answers are changing.
I can live with that.
I stop, aware that might sound presumptuous. If I get the chance, I mean.
Good.
Edward Monkford reaches down to where some coffee cups and a bowl of sugar cubes in paper wrappers sit on a tray. Absent-mindedly, he rearranges the sugar in a stack, aligning the edges until it forms a perfect square, like a Rubik's cube. Then he turns the cups so all the handles point in the same direction. I might even ask you to meet some of our clients, to help us convince them that living without an Aga and a cabinet of sports trophies won't be the end of their world. Another smile touches the corners of his eyes, and I feel myself going a little weak at the knees. This isn't like me, I think. And then, is it mutual? I give him a tiny, encouraging smile in return. A pause. So, Jane, is there anything you'd like to ask me? I think. You built One Folgate Street for yourself?
Yes.
He doesn't elaborate. So where do you live? In hotels, mostly, near whatever project I'm working on. They're perfectly bearable, so long as you put all the loose cushions in a wardrobe. He smiles again, but I get the sense he isn't joking. Don't you mind not having a home of your own? He shrugs.
It means I can focus on my work.
Something about the way he says it doesn't invite any more questions. A man comes into the room, barging in clumsily, banging the door against its stopper, already talking 19 to the dozen.
Ed, we need to talk about bandwidth. The idiots are trying to scrimp on the fiber optics. They don't understand that in 100 years' time, copper wiring will seem as outdated as lead water pipes are today.
The speaker is a scruffy, heavily built individual, an erratic growth of stubble covering his fleshy, jowly face. His hair, which is greyer than his stubble, is tied up in a ponytail. Despite the air conditioning, he's wearing shorts and flip-flops. Monkford doesn't seem perturbed by the interruption.
David, this is Jane Cavendish. She has applied to live at One Folgate Street.
So this must be David Teal, the technology partner. His eyes, set so deep in his face I can barely make out their expression, turn to me incuriously, then swivel back to Monkford.
Really, the only solution is for the town to have its own satellite. We need to rethink everything.
A dedicated satellite. That's an interesting notion, Monkford says thoughtfully. He glances at me. I'm afraid you'll have to excuse us, Jane. Of course. As I stand up, David Teal's eyes drop down toward my bare legs. Monkford sees it too, and a frown crosses his face. I get the feeling he's about to say something, but then he restrains himself. Thank you for seeing me, I add politely.
I'll be in touch soon, he says.
Then, Emma. And then, the very next day, there's an email.
Your application is approved. I can't believe it. Not least because the email contains nothing else. No explanation about when we can move in, or what their bank details are, or what we're supposed to do next. I call the agent, Mark. I'm getting to know him quite well now that I'm doing all this stuff for the application, and he isn't actually as bad as I first thought. He sounds genuinely pleased when I tell him. Since it's empty, he says, you can move in this weekend if you want. There's some paperwork to sign, and I'll need to talk you through installing the app on your phones. That's about it, really. That's about it, really. It's just sinking in that we've done it. We're going to live in one of the most amazing houses in London. Us. Me and Simon. Everything's going to be different now.
3. You are involved in a traffic accident that you know is your fault. The other driver is confused and seems to think she caused the crash. Do you tell the police it was her fault or yours? Her fault, your fault.
Now, Jane. I am sitting in the spare, empty austerity of 1 Folgate Street, utterly content. My gaze takes in the pristine blankness of the garden. I've discovered now why there aren't any flowers. The garden is modelled on what the internet tells me are karasansui, the formal meditative gardens of Buddhist temples. The shapes are symbolic: mountain, water, sky. It's a garden for contemplating, not for growing things. Edward Monkford spent a year in Japan after his wife and son died. That's what made me think to search for it. Even the internet is different here. Once Camilla had downloaded the app to my phone and laptop and handed me this special bracelet that triggers 1 Folgate Street sensors, she connected to the Wi-Fi and typed in a password. Since then, whenever I turn on a device, I'm met not by Google or Safari, but by a blank page and the word housekeeper. There are just 3 tabs: home, search, and cloud. Home brings up the current status for 1 Folgate Street's lighting, heating, and so on. There are 4 different settings to choose from: productive, peaceful, playful, and purposeful. Search takes me to the internet. Cloud is my backup and storage. Every day, housekeeper suggests what clothes I should wear, based on the weather outside, my appointments, and what's currently at the laundry. If I'm eating in, it knows what's in the fridge, how I might cook it, and how many calories it will add to my daily total. Meanwhile, the search function filters out ads, pop-ups offering me a flatter belly, distressing news stories, top tens, gossip about minor celebrities, spam, and cookies. There are no bookmarks, no history, no saved data. I am wiped clean every time I close the screen. It's strangely liberating. Sometimes I pour myself a glass of wine and simply walk around, touching things, acclimating myself to the cool, expensive textures, adjusting the precise position of a chair or vase. Of course, I was already familiar with that saying by Mies van der Rohe, less is more, but I hadn't appreciated before just how sensual less could be, how rich and voluptuous. The few pieces of furniture are design classics: Hans Fehner dining chairs in pale oak, white nickel stools, a sleek Lissoni sofa. And the house comes with a number of carefully curated but luxurious lesser props: thick white towels, bedsheets made of high thread count linen, hand-blown wine glasses with thermometer-thin stems. Every touch is a small surprise, a quiet appreciation of quality. I feel like a character in a movie. Amid so much good taste, the house somehow makes me walk more elegantly, stand in a more considered way, place myself within each vista for maximum effect. There's no one to see me, of course, but One Folgate Street itself seems almost to become my audience, filling the sparse spaces with quiet cinematic scores from Housekeeper's automated playlist. Your application is approved. That was all the email said. I'd been reading bad news into the fact the meeting was so short, but it seems Edward Monkford is inclined to brevity in all things. And I'm sure I wasn't imagining that unspoken undercurrent, that tiny charge you get when an attraction is reciprocated. Well, he knows where I am, I think. The waiting itself feels charged and sensual, a kind of silent foreplay. And then there are the flowers. On the day I moved in, they were lying on the doorstep, a huge bouquet of lilies still wrapped in plastic. No note, nothing to indicate whether this is something he does for all his new tenants or a special gesture just for me. I sent him a polite thank you anyway. 2 days later, another identical bouquet arrives. And after a week, a third, exactly the same arrangement of lilies, left in exactly the same place beside the front door. Every corner of One Folgate Street is filled with their heavy scent, but really, this is getting to be too much. When I find the fourth identical bouquet, I decide enough's enough. There's a florist's name printed on the cellophane wrapper. I call them and ask if it's possible to change the order for something else. The woman on the other end comes back sounding puzzled. I can't find any order for One Folgate Street. It may be under Edward Monkford, or the Monkford Partnership. There's nothing like that. Nothing in your area, in fact. We're based in Hammersmith. We wouldn't deliver so far north. I see, I say, perplexed. Next day, when yet more lilies arrive, I pick them up, intending to throw them in the bin. And that's when I see it. A card, the first time one's been left, on which someone has written, Emma, I will love you forever. Sleep well, my darling.
Zen, Emma. It's just as wonderful as we hoped. Well, as I hoped. Simon goes along with everything, but I can tell he still has reservations. Or perhaps he doesn't like feeling beholden to the architect for letting us live here cheap. But even Simon is pretty amazed by a showerhead the size of a dinner plate that simply turns itself on when you open the cubicle door, that identifies each of us from the waterproof bracelet we've each been given to wear, and remembers the different water temperatures we like. We wake up on our first morning with the light in the bedroom slowly fading up, an electronic sunrise, the street noises muffled to silence by the thick walls and the glass, and I realize I've had my best night's sleep in years. Unpacking, of course, takes no time at all. One Folgate Street already has lots of nice things, so our old stuff simply joins the collection in storage. Sometimes I just sit on the stairs with a mug of coffee, my knees tucked under my chin, drinking in how nice it all is. Don't spill the coffee, babe, Simon calls when he sees me. It's becoming a standing joke. We've decided it must be because I spilled the coffee that we got the house. We don't ever mention Monkford calling Simon a prick, or Simon's non-reaction. Happy? Simon asks, coming to sit next to me on the stairs. Happy, I agree. But... You want to move out, he goes. Had enough already. I knew it. It's my birthday next week. Is it, babe? I hadn't remembered. He's joking, of course. Simon always goes way over the top for things like Valentine's and my birthday. Why don't we invite a few people over? A party, you mean? I nod. On Saturday. Simon looks worried. Are we even allowed parties here? It won't get messy, I say, not like last time. I say this because the last time we threw a party, three separate neighbours called the police. Well, okay then, he says doubtfully. Saturday it is. By 9 p.m. on Saturday, the house is packed. I've put candles all the way up the stairs and outside in the garden and dimmed the lighting right down. The fact that housekeeper doesn't have a party setting does make me a bit worried at first, but I've checked the rules and no parties isn't on the list. Maybe they just forgot. But hey, a list is a list. Of course, our friends can't believe it when they walk through the door, though there are plenty of jokes about where's all the furniture and why haven't we unpacked yet. Simon's in his element. He always likes to be the envy of his friends, to have the most exclusive watch or the latest app or the coolest phone, and now he has the best place to live. I can see him adjusting to this new version of himself, proudly demonstrating the stove, the automatic entry system, the way the electric sockets are just three tiny slits in a stone wall, how even the drawers built under the bed are different on the man's side and the woman's. I'd thought about inviting Edward Monkford, but Simon persuaded me not to. Now, as Kylie's "can't get you out of my head" ripples through the crowd, I realise he was right. Monkford would loathe all this noise and mayhem and dancing. He'd probably make up another rule on the spot and throw everyone out. Just for a moment, I imagine that happening. Edward Monkford turning up uninvited, turning off the music and ordering everyone to get out. And it actually feels rather good. Which is stupid, because after all, it's my party. Simon goes past, his hands full of bottles, and leans in to kiss me. "You look great, birthday girl," he says. "Is that a new dress?" "I've had it for ages," I lie. He kisses me again. "Get a room, you two," Saul shouts over the music as Amanda pulls him into the knot of dancers. There's a lot of booze, a little bit of drugs, plenty of music and shouting. People spill into the tiny garden to smoke and get yelled at by the neighbours. But by 3 in the morning, everyone's starting to drift away. Saul spends 20 minutes trying to persuade Simon and me to come onto a club, but despite having done a couple of lines, I'm exhausted, and Simon says he's too drunk, and eventually Amanda takes Saul home. "Come to bed, Em," Simon says when they've gone. "In a minute," I say. "I'm too tired to move." "You smell gorgeous. Gorgeous," he says, nuzzling my neck. "Let's go to bed." "Sigh," I say hesitantly. "What?" he says. "I don't think I want to have sex tonight," I say. "Sorry." We haven't since the break-in. We haven't really talked about it. It's just one of those things. "You said everything would be different here," he says softly. "It will," I say. "Just not yet." "Of course," he says. "There's no hurry, Em. No hurry at all." Later, as we lie beside each other in the darkness, he says quietly, "Remember how we christened Belfort Gardens?" It had been a silly challenge we'd set ourselves, to make love in every room before we'd been there a week. He doesn't say anything else. The silence lengthens, and eventually, I fall asleep.
Now, Jane. I invite some friends to lunch, a little housewarming gathering. Mia and Richard bring their children, Freddie and Martha, and Beth and Pete bring Sam. I've known Mia since Cambridge, my oldest and closest friend. Certainly I know things her own husband doesn't, such as that in Ibiza shortly before their wedding she slept with another man and almost called it off, or that she contemplated having an abortion when she fell pregnant with Martha because her postpartum depression with Freddie had been so bad. Much as I love these people, I shouldn't have invited them together. I only did it because of the novelty of having enough space, but the fact is, however tactful my friends try to be, sooner or later they start talking to one another about their children. Richard and Pete patrol after their toddlers, as if jerked after them by invisible reins, fearful of the stone floor, those lethal stairs, the floor-to-ceiling glass windows that a running child might not even see, while the girls pour huge glasses of white wine and complain quietly but with a kind of battle-weary pride about how boring their lives have become. God, last week I fell asleep watching the 6 o'clock news.
That's nothing. I'd crashed by CBeebies.
Martha regurgitates her lunch over the stone table, while Sam manages to smear the plate glass windows with fingers previously dipped in chocolate mousse. I find myself thinking there are advantages to not having a child. A part of me just wants them all to go so I can tidy up. And then there's a funny little moment with Mia. She's helping me get the salad ready when she calls out,
"Jay, where do you keep the African spoons?"
"Oh, I donated them to the charity shop." She gives me a strange look.
"I gave you those."
"Yes, I know." Mia went to do voluntary work in an African orphanage once, and she brought me back 2 hand-carved salad spoons made by the kids. "I decided they didn't quite make the cut. Sorry, do you mind?"
"I suppose not,"
she says, with a slightly put-out expression on her face. Clearly, she does mind, but pretty soon lunch is ready and she forgets about it.
"So, Jay, how's your social life?"
Beth asks, filling her 2nd glass of wine.
"The usual drought," I say.
For years, this has been my allotted role within the group, to provide them with vicarious stories of sexual disasters that make them feel they haven't completely left all that behind, while simultaneously reassuring them that they're much better off as they are.
"What about your architect?"
Mia says. "Anything come of him?"
"Ooh, I didn't know about the architect," Beth says. "Tell."
"She fancies the man who built this house, don't you, Jay?" Pete has taken Sam outside. The child is squatting next to the patch of grass, scattering it with tiny fistfuls of gravel. I wonder if it would be spinsterish to ask him to stop.
"I haven't done anything about it, though," I say.
"Well, don't hang around," Beth says. "Grab him before it's too late." She stops, horrified at herself.
"Shit, I didn't mean..."
Grief and anguish rip at my heart, but I say calmly, "It's okay, I know what you meant." Anyway, my biological clock seems to have set itself to snooze for the time being.
"Sorry, anyway, that was unbelievably tactless of me."
"I wondered if that was him outside," Mia says. "Your architect, I mean." I frown. "What are you talking about?"
"When I got Martha's penguin from the car just now, there was a man with flowers coming to your front door."
"What sort of flowers?" I say.
"Lilies." "Jane?"
I'm already hurrying to the door. The flower mystery has been nagging at me ever since I found that strange note. As I pull the door open, the bouquet has already been laid on the step, and he's almost back at the road.
"Wait," I call after him. "Wait a moment, will you?"
He turns. He's about my age, maybe a couple of years older, his dark hair prematurely flecked with grey. His face looks drawn, and his gaze is strangely intense.
"Yes."
"Who are you?" I gesture at the bouquet. "Why do you keep bringing me flowers? My name isn't Emma."
"The flowers aren't for you, obviously," he says disgustedly. "I only keep replacing them because you keep taking them. That's why I left a note, so you'd finally get it into your thick skull that they're not there to brighten up your designer kitchen."
He stops.
"It's her birthday tomorrow. That is, it would have been."
Finally, I understand. They're not a gift. They're a memorial gesture. Like the ones people leave at the scene of a fatal accident. Mentally, I kick myself for being so wrapped up in thinking about Edward Monkford, I hadn't even considered that possibility. I'm so sorry, I say. Did she... Was it near here?
In that house.
He gestures behind me at 1 Folgate Street, and I feel a shiver go down my spine.
She died in there.
How? Realizing that might sound intrusive, I add, I mean, it's none of my business.
It depends who you ask, he interrupts.
What do you mean? He looks straight at me. His eyes are haggard.
She was murdered. The coroner recorded an open verdict, but everyone, even the police, knew she'd been killed.
First, he poisoned her mind. Then he killed her. For a moment, I wonder if this is all nonsense, if this man is simply deranged. But he seems too sincere, too ordinary for that. Who did? Who killed her? But he only shakes his head and turns away, back toward his car.
Then, Emma. It's the morning after the party, and we're still asleep when my phone rings. It's a new phone to replace the one stolen in the burglary, and it takes me a while to wake up with the unfamiliar ringtone. My head's groggy from the night before, but even so I notice how the light in the bedroom comes up in perfect sync with the sound of the phone, the windows gradually shedding their dimness. Emma Matthews, a female voice says. Yes, I say. My voice still hoarse from last night. It's Sergeant Willen, she goes, your support officer. I'm outside your flat with one of my colleagues. We've been ringing the bell. Can we come in? I'd forgotten to tell the police we were moving. We're not at that address anymore, I say. We're in Hendon, 1 Folgate Street. Hang on, Sergeant Willen says. She must put the phone against her chest to speak to someone because her voice goes muffled. Then she comes back on. We'll be there in 20 minutes, Emma. There's been an important development in your case. By the time they arrive, we've cleared away most of the party debris. There are some unfortunate red wine stains on the stone floor we'll have to deal with later, and 1 Folgate Street isn't looking its best, but even so, Sergeant Willen seems amazed. Bit different from your last place, she comments, looking around. I spent all last night trying to explain the rules to our friends, and I don't really have the energy to do it again. We got it cheap, I say, in exchange for looking after it. You said there was news, Simon says impatiently. Have you caught them then? We believe so, yes, the older police officer says. He's already introduced himself as Detective Inspector Clark. His voice is low and calm, and he has the stocky build and ruddy cheeks of a farmer. I like him immediately. 2 men were apprehended on Friday night, carrying out a burglary very similar in method to the one you suffered, he says. When we went to an address in Lewisham, we recovered a number of items listed on our database as stolen. That's fantastic, Simon says, elated. He glances at me. Isn't it, Emma? Brilliant, I say. There's a pause. Now that there's a strong possibility of a trial, Emma, we need to ask you some more questions, Sergeant Willen says. Perhaps you prefer to do this in private. That's all right, Simon says. It's great you actually got the bastards. We'll help any way we can, won't we, Em? The sergeant's still looking at me. Emma, would you rather do this without Simon present? Put like that, how can I say yes? In any case, there is nowhere private in 1 Folgate Street. The rooms all flow into one another, even the bedroom and the bathroom. Here's fine, I say. Will I have to go to court? To give evidence, I mean. A glance passes between the two of them. It depends whether they plead guilty, Sergeant Willen says. We're hoping the evidence is so strong they don't see any point in fighting it. A pause, then she says, Emma, we recovered a number of cell phones at that address we mentioned. One of them we've identified as yours. Suddenly I have a very bad feeling about this. Breathe, I tell myself. Some of the phones had photographs and videos on them, she continues. Photographs of women in sexual situations. I wait. I know what's coming now, but it seems easier to say nothing, to let the words pass over me as if they aren't real. Emma, we found evidence on your phone indicating that a man matching the description of one of the men we arrested used it to record himself engaging in a sexual act with you, she says. Can you tell us anything about that? I sense Simon's head swiveling toward me. I don't look in his direction. The silence stretches out like a thread of molten glass, getting thinner and thinner until eventually it has to snap. Yes, I say at last. My voice has shrunk to nothing. I can hardly hear myself, only the hammering in my ears. But I know I have to say something now, that I can't simply blot it out. I take a deep breath. He said he'd send the video out, I say, to everyone. Every single name in my contacts. He made me do that to him. What you saw. And he used my own phone to record it. I stop. It's like looking over a cliff edge. He had a knife, I say. Take your time, Emma. I know how hard this must be, Sergeant Willen says gently. I can't bear to look at Simon, but I force myself to go on. He said, if I told anyone, the police, my boyfriend, he'd know and send out the video. And that phone was a work phone. It has everyone stored on it, my boss, my whole company, my family. There's something else. I'm afraid we have to ask, D.I. Clark says apologetically. Is there any possibility this man could have left any DNA behind? On the bed, perhaps, or the clothes you were wearing? I shake my head. You understand the question, don't you, Emma? Sergeant Willen says. We're asking if Dion Nelson ejaculated. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Simon clench his fists. He held my nose, I say in a tiny voice. He held my nose and made me swallow. He said it all had to go, every bit, to stop the police getting any DNA. So I knew there was no point. No point in telling you. I'm sorry. Now I do manage to look at Simon. I'm sorry, I repeat. There's another long silence. In your previous statement, Emma, D.I. Clark says gently, you told us you couldn't remember exactly what happened during the break-in. Just so we understand, can you explain in your own words why you said that to us? I wanted to forget it had happened, I say. I didn't want to admit I was too scared to tell anyone. I was ashamed. I start to cry now. I didn't want to have to tell Simon, I say. There's a crash. Simon has thrown his coffee cup at the wall. Shards of white pottery and brown liquid explode across the pale stone. Simon, wait, I say desperately. But he's already gone. Drying my eyes on my sleeve, I say, will you be able to use this? To convict him, I mean. Once again, they exchange glances. It's a difficult situation, Sergeant Willen says. Juries expect DNA evidence these days, and it's impossible to identify the suspect absolutely from the video. He's careful never to show his face or the knife. She pauses. Plus, we're obliged to disclose to the defense that you initially said you couldn't remember. They may try to spin that, I'm afraid. You said there were other phones. I say, dully. Won't those women be able to give evidence? We suspect he did to others exactly what he did to you, D.I. Clark says. Offenders, particularly sexual offenders, tend to develop a pattern over time. They repeat what works and discard what doesn't. They even get a kick out of repeating themselves, turning what they do into a kind of ritual. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to trace those other victims yet. You mean none of them reported it, I say, seeing the implication. His threat worked, and they kept quiet. It looks that way, D.I. Clark says. Emma, I understand why you didn't tell anyone before. But it's important we get an accurate account of what happened. Will you come into the station and update your previous statement for us? I nod, miserably. He picks up his jacket. Thank you for being honest with us, he says kindly. I know how difficult this must be. But understand this. According to the law, any kind of forced sex, including forced oral sex, is rape. And that's what we're going to charge this man with. Simon's gone over an hour. I spend the time picking up bits of broken mug and scrubbing the wall clean. Like a whiteboard, I think. Except that what's been written here can't be erased. When he does come back, I scrutinize his face, trying to figure out his mood. His eyes are red and it looks like he's been crying. I'm sorry, I say miserably. Why, Em? He says quietly. Why didn't you tell me? I thought you'd be angry. You mean you thought I wouldn't be sympathetic? He looks bewildered as well as upset. You thought I wouldn't care? I don't know, I say. I didn't want to think about it. I was ashamed. It was so much easier just to pretend it didn't happen, and I was scared. Jesus, Em, he shouts. I know I can be a bit of an idiot sometimes, but do you really think I wouldn't care? No. I messed up, I say miserably. I couldn't talk to you about it. I'm sorry. It's like Monkford said. Deep down, you think I'm a prick. What does Monkford have to do with it? He gestures at the floor, the beautiful stone walls, the dramatic double-height void. That's why we're here, isn't it? Because I'm not good enough for you. Because our old flat wasn't good enough. This isn't about you, I say dully. And anyway, I don't think that. Suddenly he shakes his head and I can see his anger's gone as quickly as it arrived. He says, if you'd only told me. The police think he may get off, I say. I reckon I might as well get all the bad news out now. He's like, what? They didn't actually say so, but because I've changed my evidence and no other women have come forward, they clearly think he might get away with it. They said maybe there's no point in pursuing it. Oh no, he says, bawling his fists and banging them down on the stone table. I promise you this, Emma. If that creep gets acquitted, I'll kill him myself. And I know his name now. Dion Nelson.
Now, Jane. When my friends have gone, I go to my laptop and type in 1 Folgate Street. Then I add death. And finally, Emma. There are no matches. But I'm learning that Housekeeper doesn't work quite the same way Google does. Where Google throws thousands, even millions, of results at you, Housekeeper likes to select 1 perfect match and nothing else. Mostly, it's a relief not to be bombarded with alternatives. But when you don't quite know what you're looking for, it's not so good. The next day is Monday, one of my days to work at Still Hope, the charity. It's run out of 3 crowded rooms in King's Cross. The contrast with the stark, austere beauty of 1 Folgate Street couldn't be more pronounced. I have a desk there, or rather half a desk, because I share with Tessa, another part-timer, and a creaking old desktop computer. I type the same search terms into Google. Most of the results are about Edward Monkford. Irritatingly, an architectural journalist who also had the first name Emma once wrote a piece about him titled The Death of Clutter, so there are about 500 links to that. On the 6th page of results, though, I find it. An archived piece from a local paper. Inquest into Hendon death records open verdict. The inquest into the death of Emma Matthews, 26, who was found dead at her rented home in Folgate Street, South Hendon, last July, has concluded with an open verdict, despite a six-month adjournment to allow the police more time to make inquiries. Detective Inspector James Clark said, "We had a number of potential leads, which at one point did lead to an arrest. However, it was felt by the Crown Prosecution Service that there was insufficient evidence to show Emma died unlawfully. We will, of course, continue to investigate this unexplained fatality to the very best of our abilities." The house, designed by leading international architect Edward Monkford, was described by the coroner in his closing statement as a health and safety nightmare. The inquest had previously heard that Matthews's body was found at the bottom of an open, uncarpeted staircase. Local residents fought a protracted battle in 2010 to try to prevent the house from being built, with permission only finally granted by the mayor's office. Neighbour Maggie Evans said yesterday, "We warned the planners time and again something like this would happen. The best thing now would be if they pulled it down and built something more in keeping." The Monkford Partnership, which was not represented at the inquest, declined to comment yesterday. So, not two deaths, I think, but three. First Monkford's own family, then this. 1 Folgate Street is an even more tragic place than I'd realised. I picture a young woman's body lying at the bottom of those sleek stone stairs, blood spreading across the floor from a shattered skull. The coroner was right, of course. The open staircase is ridiculously dangerous. And why, once that had been proved in the most horrific way possible, hadn't Edward Monkford done something to make it safer? Wall it in with glass, say, or put up some kind of rail? But of course, I already know the answer. "My buildings make demands of people, Jane. I believe they're not intolerable." No doubt somewhere in the terms and conditions is a clause saying tenants use the staircase at their own risk.
"Jane?"
It's Abby, the office manager. I look up.
"There's someone here to see you."
She looks a little flustered, a touch of pink in her cheeks.
"He says his name's Edward Monkford. I must say, he's very good-looking. He's waiting downstairs."
He's standing in the tiny waiting area, dressed almost identically to the last time we met. Black cashmere pullover, white open-necked shirt, black trousers. The only concession to the chilly weather is a scarf looped around his neck in the French style, like a slipknot. "Hello," I say. Although what I really want to say is, "What on earth are you doing here?" He'd been studying the Still Hope posters on the walls, but when he hears my voice, he turns to me.
"It makes sense now," he says softly.
"What does?" He gestures at one of the posters.
"You lost a child too."
I shrug. "I did, yes." He doesn't say, "I'm sorry," or any of those other platitudes people come out with when they don't really know what to say. He just nods.
"I'd like to have coffee with you, Jane. I can't stop thinking about you. But if it's too soon, just tell me and I'll go away."
There are so many assumptions, so many questions and revelations in those three brief sentences that I can't quite process them all. But the first thought flashing through my brain is, I wasn't mistaken. It was mutual. And the second, even more certain, is good. So that was Cambridge, but there aren't many career openings for art history graduates. The fact is, I'd never really thought about what I wanted to do afterward. There was an internship at Sotheby's that failed to turn into a job. Then I worked in a couple of galleries.
I was called something like senior art consultant, but really I was just a glorified receptionist. Then I just sort of drifted into PR. At first I worked in the West End on media accounts, but I never felt very comfortable with that whole Soho scene. I like the city, where the clients are more buttoned down. If I'm honest, I quite like the money as well. But the work was interesting. Our clients were big financial institutions. For them, PR was all about keeping their name out of the papers, not getting it in. I'm talking too much. Edward Monkford smiles and shakes his head. I like listening to you. And you? I prompt. Did you always want to be an architect? A shrug of the lean shoulders. I spent some time working for the family business, a printing firm. I hated it. A friend of my father's was building a vacation home in Scotland and was struggling with the local architect. I persuaded him to let me do it for the same budget. I learned on the job. Are we going to go to bed together? The change of tack is so abrupt, my mouth falls open. Human relationships, like human lives, tend to accumulate the unnecessary, he says softly. Valentine's cards, romantic gestures, special dates, meaningless endearments, all the boredom and inertia of timid, conventional relationships that have run their course before they've even begun. But what if we strip all that away? There's a kind of purity to a relationship unencumbered by convention, a sense of